Well, thank you very much. As I told my colleagues, Professor Liu and Professor Sandoval, it's, I always like to follow the scientists rather than to precede them because, as you can see, the scientists continually evolve theories and are very pleased to publish scientific works and papers that have new theories of why we have these earthquakes and how they occur. Whereas the challenge to engineers is quite different. The challenge to engineers is that we need to take the information, whatever it is, at that time, and to essentially act on that information, however incomplete it might be, and do what's best and what is required and responsible for society. So my perspective is from an engineering standpoint, and I'd also like to acknowledge that slides provided by two colleagues, but the opinions are mine. So with that, we have this New Madrid seismic zone. This slide's been shown several times today. As we go on, I think particularly relating to the last presentation, we do have somewhat a different situation here. We have recorded at least evidence of earthquakes occurring not once, not twice, but maybe three or four times in the same place. And to that Kenneth Arrow and the weather forecasters, if we said you had a hurricane here and you had it once, you had it twice, you had it three times, you better be ready for it the fourth time. So this is where engineers look at this, and even though it may be imperfect. And so we can see this record. What the difference is, as I talked to the reporter from the television station before, is all of these things, except maybe a few down here, occurred before there was a built-up society. Now we have a built-up society in this region. And as we will talk about a little bit later, the consequences of these events are really immense as compared to what they were a century ago even. A few terms, these terms have been used before, but I just wanted to make sure they would be defined. We talk about this magnitude, the Richter magnitude, a single number, you've heard that before. It's a so-called logarithmic scale. So they're not quite sure what happened in New Madrid, and people have talked about an 8. They talk about a 7, 7.2, 7.3, but since the energy released is 32 times with an increase of magnitude of 1, it is important to have the right earthquake. So just to throw out frivolously 7.6 or 7.8, and I'm going to give you an example of this, it is a little bit dangerous and perhaps a waste of resources. The ground acceleration, as we saw on these hazard maps, is where we start from our engineering. And to make it in simple terms, we learned this from the space age, we like to talk in Gs, right? Everybody talks about Gs. So we talk about 0.2, 0.3 Gs. This is affected by the magnitude of the earthquake, but what on a particular site might be the appropriate level to design for? And it's not only affected by the magnitude, the distance from the epicenter, but also by the local soil conditions. And this is a really interesting phenomenon, and I've seen evidence of this in Turkey and other places, two identical buildings across the street from one another. And one stands and one doesn't. And one can blame this, and I think Professor Liu is right on, with corrupt officials and corrupt and poor engineering, but also possibly differences in local soil conditions. And most of our maps are based on what we call soft rock. So you can't just take the values off the map and design. You have to know your local conditions, and they may really give you larger forces. And then this intensity, the magnitude, and we talk about sevens. And, of course, for these historical earthquakes, there was nothing there to measure, so they only have to be guessed. And we're talking here mainly about magnitude of earthquakes greater than 7, where we have these kinds of cataclysmically increasing disasters on the modified Mercalli scale. But in reality, you can only get these numbers after the event and walk around and say that's a 9 or a 9 or a 10 or whatever it was. And we've seen plenty of this before, so I will skip this. The only interesting thing is that is you get these events and affecting a relatively large region of the country. Other earthquakes since the 1811-1812 that have been reported which are attributed to New Madrid, false 1843 earthquake, and then 1895 earthquakes, and is just exactly right on, as Professor Liu talked about. These are these possibly aftershocks in the 6 range. So we haven't seen any 7-type earthquakes, but in the 6 range, but also extending pretty far out. And then since 1895, these are not all the events, and as we will talk about, are not all due to New Madrid, but 1902, 1922, local damage, 1958, which again felt in 4 states. The first earthquake that I felt in 1968 felt in 23 states. People really, at this time even, as I'll point out, were not even, most people didn't even know we had earthquakes or ever experienced them in the Midwest. We had this earthquake in 2008, Mount Carmel, Illinois earthquake. Many people may, anybody feel that earthquake? It happened 4 or 5 in the morning and woke up a lot of people in bed. So it was kind of an interesting earthquake. We just had this earthquake last summer in Virginia, as we point out, in a region that wasn't necessarily a high seismic zone. And in fact, I was coming back from a trip, actually, to one of the points of the trip was to watch the Missouri-Baylor game in Texas, in Waco, last fall. And just as we passed through central Oklahoma, we found out there had been an earthquake then, and I was somewhat tempted to divert the trip to go down and see if I could find anything. But I've had enough experience to know that if there really was any serious damage, going there the day of the damage was not a very, very good thing. But it was kind of interesting just to be passing through this region and to hear what the people in Oklahoma were saying. Since this New Madrid earthquake, a lot of work has gone into the investigation of the local phenomenon. And I'd say most of this work has taken place over the last 40 years. So we don't have, it's not like people start studying the earthquakes in this region 200 years ago, but over the last 40 years, they've identified these other seismic zones that contribute to the map. And it's a kind of hard to explain how these are used, but at any particular site, the hazard maps are not just because of the New Madrid fault, but because of the potential effect of any of these other faults at that site. Now, this is called probabilistic seismic assessment, and it's really hard to explain because an earthquake is a singular event, and it occurs, and it isn't all these faults contributing, but all the faults contribute to that. At any rate, some of the earthquakes that have occurred more recently have been attributed to the Wabash Valley site, and you see these are the potentials of these particular sites, and they do not seem to be as high as the New Madrid. So New Madrid is kind of the king, but these other sites also may contribute to an earthquake. And this is probably the most famous slide. I think both of my predecessors have shown this slide, but it's still relatively remarkable because of the soil conditions. The soil conditions and rock conditions in the central area as opposed to California, the same kind of earthquake magnitude, we know 7-something, in New Madrid, or the San Francisco earthquake, which has also been alluded to, affect with a similar intensity far greater regions. In my simple way of thinking here, the Rocky Mountains stopped the earthquake from coming this way here, and you see they get all over here. And so we have a very wide region. And as we look at the consequences of this region being affected by an earthquake, not only in the local area. New Madrid is still not much of a place. But if you expect this whole region and the commerce to be disrupted, you really have a serious problem here. So I want to show this is obligatory. This is where you see engineers differing from the scientists. Engineers always show damage to building systems in earthquakes. I don't say we love it, but we show it. And I would like you all to look at this, and I'm sure you've all seen this before. The requirements of our codes and our design philosophy are relatively modest. They are to provide life safety. That's why we have building codes. And only possibly a slight amount of damage reduction. So therefore, we could have a heavily damaged structure, and we might fulfill the life safety objective. So as you look at these slides, look at each one and consider you might be there or right next to it. Is it going to do its job from a life safety standpoint? Also consider that you might be the owner of that facility. And the engineer comes up to you afterwards and said, is anybody killed? Nobody's killed? Well, we did the job. Good. But you're out of business. And so see you tomorrow. Okay, so we have architecturally significant damage. These are always dramatic pictures of stuff falling off here, stuff falling down. Whether or not anyone was killed in these structures is hard to identify. But, of course, these might be very important structures historically, so people are definitely concerned about those. We have here these so-called masonry shear walls, unreinforced masonry buildings, and pardon the acronyms, we have lots of acronyms in this field, URMs. And these are considered the most dangerous buildings, brick buildings. And a lot of old buildings are brick buildings. These are not built anymore. These are prohibited by building codes, but we still have a lot of them around. And obviously, these brick walls falling down, collapsing, we could see a few people getting killed in these buildings. We have steel buildings. Steel is a so-called ductile material, and we have these braced frame buildings. Now, these structures, to the owner, are going to be in pretty bad shape, but it doesn't look like they collapsed on anyone, so they essentially probably did a job here. We have, these are more modern buildings. We find a lot of apartment buildings like this, modern office buildings, ordinary concrete moment frames, engineered buildings, designed, many of them were designed with lateral load resisting systems for wind loading. And on the outside, if you saw a building like this, I saw one here in Santa Barbara, in Santa Monica with these little shear cracks on them, they're kind of neat. But you might go inside and find out this building is a total wreck inside and in danger of collapse, but it doesn't look like from the outside much happened, but you have to go inside and you see that these columns have been destroyed. This is actually a picture that I took in Haiti a couple of years ago after the earthquake there. The outside walls are obviously outside. This building is barely hanging on, so in a sense, it could have met a life safety objective, but it really was pretty scary as you see these columns collapse, and certainly doesn't meet our expectations. This one is kind of neat, of interest, because all the buildings I showed you before, probably none of them were designed for earthquake forces. As I'm going to mention, the earthquake codes are relatively recent as far as their enforcement. This is a brand new building, probably in Turkey, I'm not sure, but I saw one like this in Turkey made of a material called precast concrete. That is where the columns and the beams are all cast in the factory and put together. And even before the building was opened, the earthquake came along. Why the site was right next to the earthquake fault in Turkey is a little hard to understand. The building was totally useless. And actually, there were three or four buildings like this in Turkey built by major international corporations that failed and were designed for the code, but the code was inadequate. Now, this is just last year. We have the damage in Washington, D.C. from Mineral, Virginia earthquakes. And why is this kind of interesting? Because this earthquake tended to pick out important buildings that were, to us, historical buildings, like what's more important than the Washington Monument? Or the Smithsonian towers here were actually cracked. And you've probably all seen these pictures of these so-called engineers who got this kind of glory job to go up and measure the cracks on the Washington Monument. I think this is probably a waste of time to do this. Repairing them is important. I think someone gave a lot of money to repair these. And the National Cathedral, the gargoyle getting knocked off the National Cathedral. But this earthquake, interestingly enough, about 100 miles or so away from Washington, D.C., it picked out these buildings, these masonry buildings that were tall, slender masonry buildings, and that is because of the idea that Professor Sandoval talked about of these waves, these traveling waves, and the waves tend to filter out or attenuate as you get further from the earthquake site. So the types of waves, the wavelengths that match the dynamic properties of these buildings went all the way to Washington, where the other ones kind of died out on the way. And that's and that was very unusual. And usually it's some kind of a poor building that it's expected to fail, but this really caught the attention of a lot of people that these earthquakes that can occur in the east can cause damage quite far away from the site. Now we get into a different type of damage, so-called non-structural systems or components. This is an engineering term that refers to codes, and obviously if the structural elements hold up the building, the non-structural elements support the function of the building. These are architectural equipment and building contents. You can get killed, however. So these can't be ignored. The non-structural can still cause damage. And the thing that is important about non-structural and is becoming increasingly important is that the majority of the financial loss in earthquakes is due to in the United States in a high-tech environment is due to non-structural systems. The losses can even exceed 50% of the total cost of the structure, even though the structure itself might not be damaged. This is another one that I stopped and took on that same trip. On the way back up, we went in to look at Joplin, and this is, I think, the St. John's Hospital there. And it caught my eye. You see those braces, those same steel braces that we saw in one of the earlier slides that were bent seem to still be in place here, but the building's a total loss, as we've all heard, because of all the things inside of it are totally ruined. This is, of course, not an earthquake, but still emphasizes how important these non-structural items are. Here we have architectural components, parapets and canopies, and obviously, if this is your car and you're in it, you've had it, and then this is another one. And so these parapets are very vulnerable. This is in the Virginia earthquake again. I've got the slides. Ceiling collapses. We see these in schools and in other buildings, and these, of course, are a problem. Chimney collapses. It's said that in the 1811-1812 earthquake that there may have been some chimneys in St. Louis that were knocked over. Do that. Yeah, might be fine. We have additional non-structural types of damage here, sprinkler systems, and of course a sprinkler system failing can have the water coming on. We had a case in our university where people objected to their building being upgraded for earthquake protection because they were afraid the sprinklers would fail and the water would destroy their experiments. So there's all kinds of interpretations. This is a really important one, emergency power equipment. People are very interested and feel secure that if the electric power goes out, that the emergency power generators will function afterwards and provide them power, particularly hospitals, other critical facilities. But if they are not properly secured, they may not work either. So we have lots of problems with not the non-structural effects. And then the contents of the structure, furnishings, record storage systems, computer systems, production systems, and other things, and a lot of those that we didn't have in older structures. And you can see, if you still have paper records, they're going to wind up on the floor. The office will be a total mess. And they've shown that if a building, if a business sometimes is out of is destroyed like this and not able to function for a week, a lot of them never open again. Our computer systems, and particularly we have our mainframe systems, getting tipped over is obviously going to be very destructive and expensive. And these records, as far as paper records go, are destroyed. Now more and more records are electronic, and so maybe some of these problems won't be quite as severe. And then in our big box stores, we have some concern because of these large racks. Every time I walk into a Home Depot or a Sam's store, I'll take a look at these racks and figure what might happen if one of those should come down. Okay, so I got to, thanks, everybody's worried about maybe it'll slow me down a little bit. Okay, so what do we do about all this? Whether or not we're going to have another earthquake or not, I leave it to the scientists, but the effect of the earthquake, if we do have it, is pretty clear. And so whose responsibility is this? And a lot of the responsibility from the governmental standpoint has been coming through actions of FEMA, and Sue and her colleagues have done an extraordinary job in really trying to prepare the community to be able to mitigate the effect of earthquakes. But I want to talk about what's going on here in Missouri, what has happened. And as far as I can see, most of the work has gone on in the last 30 to 40 years, and it was spearheaded by a professor at St. Louis University, Professor Otto Nutley. And he published a paper in the early 1970s trying to quantify the earthquake risk in the New Madrid seismic zone. They produced these scientific tools, seismic design spectra, basically, which are tools that engineers use to calculate the proper forces to design for at a particular site. And, in fact, these tools were used for the earthquake design of the Callaway Nuclear Power Plant, which I'm glad to report is puffing away really very well today. As I drove over here, I was take a look and see that, and it happens to be that the shell of those, that was something that I worked on and is one of my fields of interest. So that is done very well and has been designed for seismic forces as specified by Professor Nutley. And he also raised some questions about the appropriate level of ground shaking in St. Louis before our building code provisions were enforced, and got a lot of unjust criticism from the local politicians who did not want anyone to say that there was an earthquake hazard in St. Louis. I got into this in the 1980s, and a couple of kind of maverick engineers approached me and said that, you know, that the city of St. Louis and the county don't enforce the provisions of the applicable building code for earthquakes. And sure enough, we looked into it, and the provisions were this way, that if, in fact, there had been no prior damage in a region, then you had an exclusion provision and you didn't have to enforce that provision of the code. Well, we mounted a coalition of contractors, architects, engineers, other public officials, and we were able then to get the building commissioner, actually had to get him fired and replaced, to put in someone who would enforce the building code. And this was a very dramatic event as I look back on it. But we got the building code enforced. The building code, however, only applies to new construction. So you have exactly 0% of the structures covered at that time, and all 100% of the structures are deficient that haven't been done voluntarily. So it takes some time before we get the building, the new buildings in place and proper buildings that are designed for earthquake forces. We also had legislation. This one I hate to have you read the whole thing, because I was talking to the person who was designing this legislation, and he was a lawyer, of course, not an engineer or a scientist, but a legislative intern, and he insisted that they put in this magnitude 7.6, the Mercalli index of 7, and New Madrid earthquake, and be very specific, and all this language actually appears in the law, and I doubt that any of those legislatures up there, legislators, really, you know, understood all of this. But the intent was that in those counties in which you could have an effect similar to the New Madrid earthquake and it would be affected, that those counties would have to adopt a building code. Since we don't have a statewide building code in Missouri, they would have to adopt a building code equivalent to one of the national building codes. So that happened, and the state was... I think a lot of people are very proud of Missouri for doing this. Also, there was additional legislation requiring earthquake drills in schools. And I think those of you who have children or grandchildren who have been in schools in the last 20 or 30 years have noticed that earthquake drills have come in, and included also material and physical science courses. So we have basically, in a kind of a slow way, educated the emerging parts of our society to the fact that there is an earthquake threat in Missouri. I also didn't point on here, but there have been a couple commissions established. One is the Seismic Safety Commission, which was mentioned in the introduction. Eric is a member of that. and Sue is served with that for a long time, and we have a broad responsibility for earthquake hazard mitigation, response, and recovery in Missouri. And there's also another group called the SAVE Coalition, sorry for the acronyms, but they have the responsibility for post-earthquake evaluation and damage. You've probably seen red, yellow, and green cards classified. And in fact, they've been mobilized twice in Joplin and for tornado damage in Branson also, and have served very well. And turns out are a model agency. Now we get to these existing structures, the so-called retrofit, and this is the weak part of it. The building codes do not require retrofit of existing structures, and as they have been interpreted in most of parts of our region, even major upgrades have not forced retrofit. So retrofit or strengthening of buildings basically has been a voluntary situation. And this means that the longer we have between the next major earthquake, then more and more of our older buildings and infrastructure will be replaced, and better we have a chance of having less damage. But as far as the retrofit, and I put this in bold letters, is elective and it needs encouragement, and we've been trying to figure out how to encourage people to do this, because in general, retrofit funds, since they are voluntary, compete with other things like a higher grade of carpeting or something else that's important to a building owner, and don't get a very good rap. FEMA invested tens of millions of dollars to develop appropriate standards for retrofit, recognizing that you can't just simply say, okay, you want to retrofit your structure, bring it up to the same level as a new building. In some cases, actually, the reason for retrofit is to get it up to a higher level. Some cases, the best we can do is for collapse control and accept some life safety damage. The bottom line is very important. The financial and insurance institutions and other agencies can, in fact, force retrofit by their power. There have been some high-profile retrofits. I'd like to show you some examples of those in the private sector. And there's BI, business interruption. In other words, the people, it's kind of crass to say this, but who have invested in the retrofit, it hasn't always been to protect the employees or the workers there. It's to protect their business. Whatever, it happens. Schools have received a lot of attention. I've been working mostly on this. As we heard in the previous talk, the number of schools that were damaged in China and also in Italy have made really accelerated the efforts in this country. Major bridges have been retrofit because of their obvious importance in post-earthquake response and recovery, and we have a significant number of historic and landmark buildings retrofit, usually public sector buildings, in which hasn't really been a cost issue, but it's because it's the Salt Lake City Hall or some other building deemed important, then we have to fix that up. Okay, so we talk about some kind of low-level retrofit or sort of things that we can't possibly do a complete retrofit. So it's been found out that if we can include the retrofit when other renovations are going on, that it's far cheaper than to do earthquake retrofit on its own. And in reality, this is how retrofit often occurs. Incremental retrofit, meaning you spread it out over a period of time, that works with budget cycles, is done in a lot of schools. A very simple example is every summer, the maintenance people in the school have some time, and they can kind of do upgrades as you go along. We couldn't do this previously until provisions were made, because since retrofit was voluntary, once the engineer touched it, once anything was done, they assumed a certain liability. If you didn't do anything, you didn't have any liability. So this was kind of a poor idea. So incremental retrofit has come in, and these partial non-structural retrofit, and this is something that you can pick up some literature on, how to do this in your own building or your own house, secure water heaters, light fixtures, and FEMA provides information for for people to do this also in the residential sector, so a lot of us can do partial retrofit. Some examples of retrofit, this is the Los Angeles Anheuser-Busch Brewery where this wall was built, a buttress wall before and after. And this was a great success because in the Loma Prieta earthquake, Northridge earthquake, this retrofit was completed maybe a few weeks or a month before the earthquake occurred. The earthquake occurred, and this brewery was able to bottle, I guess, hundreds of thousands of cans of water to distribute to the population after the earthquake. And I guess they continue to brew beer as well, but they got a lot of good PR out of this. They got so excited. The tanks here came to the St. Louis Brewery and decided to retrofit some of their historic buildings there and put this buttress building. Some of our local engineers worked on this project, put this buttress building into protect their brew house. And this is the construction of this brew house, and then added Brace Friends at the upper level. Just as an aside, they used to be quite proud of talking about this to the community, but as time has gone on, I think that they've been less anxious to show this off to the general community. Bridges, if you ride the Metrolink into St. Louis from the airport and got down to the ball game, you'll see these relatively ugly things on all these bridge bents here, or you can see them on the highway when you go in. It turns out, again, that the approaches to the Poplar Street Bridge are found to be very vulnerable. They're very similar to the design of the Nimitz Freeway, which collapsed in the Loma Prieta earthquake, and so they got a lot of attention. And most of these are still going on. This has been going on for a long time, and these are basically devices that confine the concrete in these concrete columns and hopefully will enable these structures to be functioning after the earthquake, because St. Louis is kind of an island, and in order to get things in and out, we need our major bridges. Schools, as I said, are kind of a different point because they don't have a lot of resources. This is one school district close to where I live, and this particular retrofit was a high-profile retrofit in that it was on a bond issue, and the bond issue was passed for seismic retrofit, and these are some of the considerations that the architects in evaluating the structure, since it was an older structure, they had to evaluate the material strength, the connections, and as we call the load path. And they also designed this structure for possibly a higher performance objective. And the higher performance objective meant that they were not satisfied with just the life safety, but to go to immediate occupancy or the fully operational performance objective, possibly because a school would possibly be used as an emergency shelter. And these performance objectives are the new philosophy of our seismic design in order to allow the owner to select a higher performance level. And, of course, they're very appealing because the owners, who probably wouldn't elect to retrofit a structure, might if they could feel that that retrofit structure would survive the earthquake and they'd be back in business. And, of course, this was done with this idea of integrating it with remodeling the building in general. So there's a lot of other constraints in the building, and this is the way they stated it. They considered this an incremental retrofit, and they had to spend additional effort in coordinating the retrofit. But it got done. Of course, it hasn't been fully tested yet. But there are very few schools that have this sort of effect. This is a much, much more modest project. I just visited this one a few weeks ago in Bloomfield, Missouri, in that region down near the Boot Hill there. And they got a modest grant through FEMA and Missouri Seismic, a State Emergency Management Agency, of $10,000. And they used that all for material, and school personnel and local volunteers did this work. And it's things like strapping down their computers, and they're proud of their, can't see it too well, their fish tank, which they got better glass for and put in some brackets in the fish tank and tied some of their bookshelves together in the library, which is very important to the librarians, and of course not to have the kids exposed. So this is, and the work is going to continue on, and they're very proud of this, and there's a few other schools in Missouri that are able to get these grants from FEMA, and obviously these are not going to keep the building up, but they at least reduce the hazard to the occupants. This was the topic that I got started out with here, and I made a change at this point, even if the scientists have convinced you. Otherwise, I say, when it happens again, are we ready? And the question is, what does it mean to be ready, and when do we start? And I just want to give you the kind of party line here. And this is the New Madrid scenario for Missouri as assessed by the Mid-America Earthquake Center 2008 under a FEMA project. And this considers this magnitude of 7.7. So this might be on the high end, but that's what they specify, 7.7. It's the maximum considered earthquake. But this particular earthquake is a consideration for not what's likely to happen, but what possibly could happen, which is the charge if you're in charge of catastrophic planning. If you're you have to deal with catastrophic planning, you have to plan for the worst. And this is what they published. Now, this is not done by looking at every building. This is done in a statistical manner. Maybe doesn't take into account all of the things, some of the mitigation measures that have gone into place. So we're talking about 800 dead, this many casualties. This will catch your eye. $40 billion direct economic loss. This is the exposure to the community. So this obviously 200 years ago this part wasn't there, and probably these other ones wouldn't have applied. So this is what they have published in their report, and which is I guess the closest as we would have to an official position. My view of this, I just want to talk about some of the actions we've taken. We haven't ignored this. And I feel since the 1980s, we've really increased the awareness of the general community. I think most people, if we've given this talk, had this program 20 or 30 years ago, we'd be talking to ourselves here. People say, oh, we don't have earthquakes in Missouri. I heard a lot of that. But I think especially the younger generation now know that there's an earthquake threat. We have facilities covered by building codes and have been designed for seismic. Our high occupancy structures, at least some of those, just because they've been relatively new, are designed for seismic forces. The major bridges have been retrofit or strengthened against collapse because of their necessity for post-earthquake response. And many of these critical facilities, such as the hospitals, again, not only the hospital that you talked about in Memphis, but many other hospitals have spent considerable funds in designing for seismic or upgrading and retrofit. They don't always brag about it, but they have done that. And just as an aside, when we went to Haiti and we looked there, we saw the terrible problem that the hospitals had when their structures were not able to handle the earthquake forces and people out in tents and operations going on outside in tents, and some equipment lying around that couldn't be run because of the power generators. So I think it's probably an investment a hospital has to make. The negative aspects, the awareness has not progressed throughout society, and we're still, most of our buildings are still not covered by code because they weren't designed that way. One and two family residential buildings are vulnerable. This is a tragedy here, which could have been certainly improved. We've had a lot of loft buildings and other industrial buildings converted to residential buildings, and because of a narrow interpretation of the code, seismic upgrading was not enforced in these buildings. And it's not because the officials didn't want to do it, but it's the idea that if they force seismic upgrading, the projects may not have happened. So there's a trade-off between the developers and the and the engineers and the developers wind up usually winning most of those battles. We have this deteriorating infrastructure. It's been well publicized. It's on television almost every other day, how bad our infrastructure is. So the bad infrastructure also is bad because it's weak seismically. And again, the school buildings, which I think are really one of the major problems that we have not been able to address fully. Vulnerable school buildings are an intolerable threat. The last slide I want to close with is, what is it that exactly we're talking about here? We're talking about the earthquake. It comes. The structure fell down. We're still alive, hopefully. Is that the end? That's not the end. That's the beginning. And people have now started to look at this post-event recovery or getting back to normal. I like to think of this as a difference between, I hate to use these terms, between a disaster and a catastrophe. Katrina was a catastrophe. We have lots of hurricanes that cause tremendous damage. Disaster. And the Fukushima plant, because of the tsunami and the earthquake occurring together, is a catastrophe. Many other earthquakes have only been disasters. So this is maybe a more realistic view of it, and this has been done in California by these organizations. And in this case, getting back to normal, people have looked at not necessarily the maximum considered earthquake, this 7.7, but maybe looking at one of these that I think, even if you're a doubter of that, a 6.2, 6.3 earthquake, what's it going to take to get back to normal? And they learned a lot of this from Katrina, and some of these are things you might not expect. One thing is, after the earthquake, is there going to be anybody that's going to be able to live there to rebuild it? If we do have the funds, how are you going to get them back? And we know New Orleans was depopulated. Provision of business continuity. Are there businesses going to be able to survive long enough to actually get back into business if we can get the damage cleaned up? And even the continuity of government functioning is a consideration. So I think, as I understand it, a lot of this planning is based on this kind of design-based earthquake, that is, in our terms, the 6.2, 6.3, rather maybe than the 7.7 earthquake that we probably couldn't afford to deal with. So this seems to be the kind of trend, getting things back to normal. The other option, I guess, is to evacuate that part of the planet and move over someplace else, and I don't think we're prepared to do this. So with that, I think hopefully we didn't use up too much time, and I thank you for your attention.